America was idealistic at that time. And we were going to change the world. And young people, I thought, oh, well, now all of these races are going to die. And we've uncovered this concept. And we will, you know, we'll all be of the country that we aspire to be.
It's How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. You know my guest today. I am telling you, you know my guest. But here's the twist, dear listener. You don't know her at all. Sonia Manzano may have been your favorite teacher. She may have been a friendly face you saw every day. She may have been your first childhood crush. For 44 years, Sonia played Maria on Sesame Street, and if you are anything like me, you thought Sonia was Maria, the upbeat and endlessly patient friend of humans and Muppets alike. But although Maria was Sonia, Sonia was definitely not Maria. Sonia Manzano escaped a difficult childhood in the South Bronx to become an actress, a writer, an educator, a memoirist, and I am so pleased to welcome Sonia Manzano to How to Be Amazing. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
I see you wrote down my name on a notepad, but it, what did you wrote down? Michael
Egan Black.
How did you spell Ian?
E-G-A-N.
Egan.
Egan.
Oh, I like that. Michael Egan Black.
Egan Black, no.
Right. I may go by that from now on. I like that a lot.
Sorry, I misheard.
No, no, no. Look, when Sonia Manzano educates you, you take that lesson. I had thought all these years it was Ian.
Yes.
Apparently it's Egan.
Right.
And
well,
who am I to quibble with you?
Plus, I get called Maria all the time in answer to
I'm
it.
Sure
so
you
there
do.
You are.
I'm sure you do. Do you feel inseparable from Maria?
I do. I do. And I feel it's like being an invisible celebrity because people stop and they look at me and I could see their thought process. Where do I know her from?
Right.
Where does she looks like? Or, you know, and they're not exactly sure. And they sometimes they do know who I am and sometimes they don't.
Now, do you ever then say, from Sesame Street, I'm Maria? Or do you just let them stew
well, not in
their
that,
own?
Not in that tone.
In that annoyed tone. God damn it, I'm
no,
Maria from Sesame Street.
Maria, you get a life. No, no, no. I do tell them who I am. I don't want to be cruel.
All right, so let us begin today. On June 29th, 2015, that's the day you announced your retirement. And you made an announcement to, I guess it was a small group of librarians. Was this a public event?
Yes, it was. It was the National Association of Librarians. And it was a big convention that they hold every year in various cities in the country. And this one was held in San Francisco. So I mentioned my retirement, which the workshop knew about. And as a segue into the memoir, obviously, because the memoir is sort of like about growing up. And
the memoir is called Becoming Maria. It came out in 2015.
Right.
And I have read it, and it is fantastic, and I'm going to recommend it right here at the outset of the interview.
Thank you. So then I went on, and the teachers and librarians tweeted the fact that I had announced that I had left Sesame Street. By the time I got to the, you know how you turn your phone off when you get on the plane? By the time I got to the East Coast, it was national news.
Finally tonight, after a remarkable 44 years with Big Bird, Grover, and Oscar the Grouch, the actress who plays the beloved Maria is moving away from Sesame Street.
So there was a lot of fury. I mean, or not fury, or you know, a lot of hubbub about my retirement. And it was just wonderful. I felt great.
Did it surprise you?
I suppose it did, yes. To the extent, I'm not going to be falsely modest. I know that we've made an impact. I know that I particularly have made an impact on the lives of children and who we see on television. But I didn't realize that Judy Woodruff was going to call me an icon on the PBS NewsHour. That was pretty cool.
Finally tonight, as she announces her retirement, an icon of children's television looks back at her life and how she got to Sesame Street. Jeffrey Brown has the story.
What is the impact you feel like you've made?
I was one of the first Latins on television as a real person, and it had special meaning for me because I was raised in the 50s in the South Bronx, and I watched a lot of television. And this was a time when Latin people were invisible. We weren't in newspaper stories. We weren't on television. And so we kind of lived in this ghetto. And I looked towards television as kind of the window out into the world. And I wondered where those exotic places were, like the suburbs and those lawns. And where were those people actually?
Did you believe in those places?
I did.
Did they feel real to you?
They did. Even though... This is the power of the media. Even though it had nothing to do with my existence, there was nothing that I could relate to, you know, nothing was like me. I still believed that those places existed. And also I wondered what my part was going to be in it, where I was going to fit in.
So you envisioned there was a larger world, or specifically America, out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you knew you would eventually be in it.
I felt that I would eventually be in it. And in this political climate that we live in, it's so remarkably negative. I find it amazing that when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be part of American culture, even though I felt the disdain of teachers because I was brown and poor, even though I suspected my parents were being exploited. I still felt that somehow I believed all of that stuff about America being great and inclusive and all of that.
Do you still believe it?
I believe it now. I will believe it.
You choose to believe it.
I choose to believe it.
What was the South Bronx like in the 50s and 60s?
Well, we lived in a very sort of isolated community. Everybody knew each other. When I go back...
What were the boundaries of your world? I mean, like geographically, like how big was it?
Maybe it was... 10 blocks.
Yeah.
It was Crotona Park. This was before the Cross Bronx Expressway cut right through that neighborhood. And the beauty part of it was there was the 3rd Avenue L was still up. So even though
it's an elevated train. Now famous, I mean, New York for the High Line, the park. But at the time, it was an actual subway that ran above.
Ran above all the way 3rd Avenue. So though we were isolated, you could get on this train with wicker chairs and be on Orchard Street eating a caniche in like half an hour going to the Bargains. We would go down to Orchard Street and
for the Bargains.
For the Bargains.
That's the Lower East Side of
the Lower East Side, of course. So, and see a completely different group of people.
Jews. You can say Jews.
Yes,
it's fine.
Jews. You know, and yarmulkes, and you know, it's all very interesting. And they actually sold pickles in barrels.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, you could pick a pickle from a barrel. That was like really fabulous.
And did you take advantage of the city when you were young? Were you able to?
My sister would take us to, and she would, you know, getting on the train was like getting on the Starship Enterprise and Star Trek, you know, because you were going to go to where no man has ever gone before or no Puerto Ricans have ever gone before. So we would, but not much. We'd go to Orchard Beach and we'd go to Bear Mountain.
Your parents came from Puerto Rico. Do I have this right? They were given like worker visas or something to come and work in factories?
They didn't have worker visas.
I mean, I know that wasn't called that.
No, it wasn't called that. And I found this out through my research that after the Second World War, there was this big boom of industry. In New York, there were factories for everything. There were button factories and hat factories and people, they needed seamstresses. And the garment district was thriving. And so they would go to Puerto Rico, the businessmen.
Well, I'm just to interrupt because I'm not sure I understand. What was the status of Puerto Rico as a territory then?
It was exactly
the
what
same.
It is now.
Got it.
Right, right. That happened. It has been a territory since 1921, the Jones Act. Was what made Puerto Rican citizens because a woman, Puerto Rico is part of Spain, and it was part of the spoils after the Spanish-American War and the United States said, oh, we get them too? Oh, okay, now what do we do with them? And then, oh, well, we were really interested in Cuba, but, you know, okay, we'll have to take Puerto Rico and the Philippines as well, I think. And then, but no one had citizenship. So some people in Puerto Rico said, look, if we're not going to be Spaniards and you took us from Spain, we have to be something. And she was the one who initiated the Jones Act. And so we are citizens. Sometimes referred to as migrant would be the more appropriate term as opposed to immigrant. But it was a horrible. The stories of poverty were unrelenting and miserable. And so my parents, who were poor, and they met here in the United States, and they came to find work. The men would join the army, which my father was in the service, and women would come and sew. And they were invited. There were flyers that businessmen would hand out and say, come to the United States and work. And it was like $24 on Pan Am to come. Uh-huh. And they were paratrooper planes. So many of these Puerto Rican people they would bring their own like beach chairs and sit on along the sides.
Right.
And my mother would tell this story about this barber who came with his tools in a box, and every time the plane like moved in a certain way, all of his stuff would go.
Sounds dangerous. Scissors falling all over the place.
Yeah, I know.
But they didn't have to parachute out of the plane. Like the plane would land, and they would get a JFK.
Didn't just slow down and say, "This is your stop."
You write a lot about your childhood in your memoir, Becoming Maria, and there's a lot of. It seems like you have a lot of conflicted emotions about growing up in that time with that family. Is there an overarching experience that you feel like you had? I mean, is it when you think back, is there a joy to it? Is it mostly pain? What is it?
It was both. I think that's the situation a lot of kids find themselves in. You might not approve of what your parents' behavior, but on the other hand, how could I love the music my father plays?
I know that you had kind of cut him out of your life for a number of years, and then you reopened your relationship with him as you started to write the memoir.
Right.
What was that process like?
Well, I was really nervous about going to see him, and my brothers had kept contact with him, but I really wanted to know, have some sort of closure, some sort of understanding. So I said, so, you know, we had, you know, heart-to-heart talks, and I said, you know, how could this go on? And he said, your mother, she always wanted to do what she wanted to do. I loved her. I still love her. It was like, he just said, and this had nothing to do with you. Hmm. Parents don't realize that everything they do has something to do with their children. They'll say things in front of them that you know, merit some under some explanation. They'll act in certain ways. And kids are not subhumans. They understand. They have feelings that adults give out. And to think that they're not absorbing everything that's going on around them is foolish. So my father says, had nothing to do with you. I mean, they came from such horrible upbringings where there's nothing to eat or you're an indentured servant and there was casual cruelty, that the fact that we ate and the violence was only between the two of them for the most part. I mean, we weren't in it. They said, What's
the big deal?
What's the big deal? Life is life. Such is life.
And
I'll add this about my siblings. It's like we had different parents. They see them differently than I saw them.
Oh, interesting.
So one will say, well, yeah, that happened, but it wasn't so bad. Or, you know, well, it didn't happen like that. I'm saying, excuse me, are we related? I mean, were we in the same household? So like four children in a household could have different sensibilities of what the story is.
Was it a challenge for you to sit down and write this story?
It was. It was because you had to really, you know, in order to be truthful, in order not to look at the words the next day and say, this is baloney.
Right.
You had to really face the things, and one of the hardest things for me to face and admit was that when my parents would talk about the poverty of Puerto Rico, they would sometimes cite things like, oh, did you hear the joke about the peasant who kept reinfecting his wounds in order to continue to stay on the dole to support his family? And they would laugh. And I would think, that's not funny.
No, it doesn't sound
funny. It's not funny. Why are you laughing about this guy's misery? This is the only way he could support his parents. Well, so that was, you know, I was like, I didn't like them then. Well, now I know that I had the luxury of feeling sympathy because I wasn't starving.
There's such a strong sense of self in your book. This sense of... I don't know, knowing yourself might be too strong because people, it takes a long time to know yourself. But this kind of spine of steel that you seem to have, and looking around at particularly the other girls in your neighborhood, and hearing them being put down by teachers as saying, well, this one's going to get pregnant or this one's going to end up so and so. But it seems like you always had a sense of remove from that, at least internally. Where did that come from?
I don't know. I know what you mean when the teachers were criticizing my friends and saying I was the only one who was going to overcome the neighborhood. And I was angry with him for separating me from them, even though the other part of me was glad that I was separated from them.
Did you yourself feel separate in some capacity?
I did. And I think it's because, I mean, we're all born with a certain set of skills, which I always say when I talk about kids in any forum, I say they have their own set of skills. It's not just us, like, you know, inculcating them with information. But anyway, I think that I've had I have a capacity to see the obvious.
What does that mean?
My mother kept wishing for my father to change his behavior when after 30 years, it was clear to me it wasn't going to happen. Girls would get pregnant over and over, the same story, not even a different story. So then, but every time it happened, people would go, oh my God, how did it happen?
Right.
I'm thinking, what do you think it happened? The way it happened the first 8 times. So to me, that was always exasperating.
Was there no part of you that felt like it would be so easy to fall into this world and maybe comfortable?
I don't think so. I always knew that there was something out there, especially because I always think of Maya Angelou when she, I'll get back to my point, but Maya Angelou, she had this wonderful poem when Clinton was at Clinton's inauguration,
into
and
the
she
palms
talks about
of
throw
your
off
hands,
and go.
Molded into the shape of your most private need, sculpted into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here, on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out and upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country.
No, I felt my parents were always wearing a yoke, looking down. And they never got ahead. And I just, they never kind of got out of this insulated pattern of struggle. And there was things out there. I mean, when I saw Barbara Streisand on television, I went, oh my goodness, there is a bigger world out there. Look at a person who looks like that on television and sings like that. I mean, I just kind of embraced that kind of stuff.
Conversely, did you ever ask your friends from the neighborhood why, or get a sense from them like why they couldn't, why they didn't have that same thing that you had?
I don't know. I was so disappointed when my friend, and we had made so many plans. We were going to get an apartment. We were going to be secretaries. And whatever that meant. I didn't even know what that was. Everybody was going to be like,
you sit in an office and you smoke
cigarettes right, like madmen, right?
Yeah.
So I was very shocked that she fell right in line with what, the low expectations of the neighborhood. one could look at it from her point of view and say that I was being annoying and obnoxious and overbearing.
Sonia Manzano says she always knew there was something out there for her beyond the low expectations of her South Bronx neighborhood growing up. By her early 20s, she was one of a few working Latin actors on television after she landed her role of Maria on a new show called Sesame Street. Coming up, we talk about those early days of making the iconic show, how she got pushed into writing for the show, how she grew comfortable being a role model, and she totally dishes on which Muppet had a bad drinking problem. What was it about performing that hit you?
Oh, well, I used to find a lot of comfort watching television. So there used to be something called Million Dollar Movie in those days. And you could watch movies. And I'd watch the movie every day at 4. I saw King Kong like every time it was on television. But there would be all these musicals with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So I'd go through the TV guide and if it said drama, it wasn't that interesting. But if war movies, forget, Back to Bataan didn't do a thing for me, but any musical I would watch. And I was especially taken by those Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. They were so frothy and light and airy and smart.
Please don't ask me to stay.
All right, I won't. Don't go. I have so many things to say to you.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one.
And utterly different than your life.
Yes.
I mean, essentially science fiction from your life.
Yes, yes. Yes, but I was so inspired.
Although you had music, I mean, and you had singing and you had dancing.
Yes,
and, you had...
and we also had the Little Rascals. And they would always put on these shows of Darla and Alfalfa, and they would all be these great tap dancing kids. And, you know, I tried to do that in my living room and nobody came. But and also, these kids were such professional dancers. I just love that.
But I feel like every kid does that. Like, every kid will watch TV and then put on a little show for their parents and you know, sing and dance and whatever. But there's a big difference. Or there's something in performers that translates that to, and this is what I'm going to do with my life. Was there a moment for you when that switched on?
I don't remember that moment. I know that when you're performing and when you're writing, which is what I'm doing more now, no one can touch you. You're an actor, so that you must have that feeling as well when you're in a song or doing a scene. You're invincible, because you're not you. It's somebody else or something. So you're somehow outside of yourself.
And yet, the character that you really made your career with, Maria, really is you in many respects,
right.
In most respects. I mean, you make a great point of saying that the Children's Theater Television Workshop really wanted Maria to be Sonia, didn't want you to put on anything, didn't want you to play a character.
Right.
Did you have that same freedom, essentially not playing a character, as you did when, like, you were in Godspell?
Yes, I was in Godspell, too. I think I didn't know what this show was about. This was insane. Clowns doing these Bible stories, none of which I had ever heard, let me add, even though I went to religious instruction. But I thought that... don't put anything on. If you don't understand it, just be yourself at this point during Godspell. And I think that's why I was successful in it, because I did think it was kind of weird and I did react that way. I did perform tongue in cheek. Like, how did I find myself around 9 clowns?
Turn back, oh man, forswear thy foolish ways. Earth and none may count her days. Da, 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 da. Yet thou
I should note that this is not some regional theater production of Godspell. This is the original production of Godspell that Sonia first became involved with. Well, why don't you tell the story?
Well, I was a student at Carnegie Mellon University and part of a senior project. John Michael Tablick was the student, the directing student, and his senior project was to do Godspell, the parables of St. Matthew.
And as told by hippie clowns.
As told by hippie clowns and rock and roll garage music.
We had Lin-Manuel Miranda on before Hamilton had come out, and he's like, you know, I'm doing this musical about essentially hip-hop biography of Hamilton. I'm like, well, that sounds like he did the best idea or the worst idea, and I don't know which. And Godspell on the page sounds the same.
Sounds the same.
This could be awful. And yet, it took off.
It was so fabulous. And I was the sexy clown, though I wasn't Mary Magdalene. And I mean, that came easily to me.
To be the sexy clown.
To be the sexy clown. And it was a wonderful collaborative effort. The costume designer put me in a slinky little brassiere with tassels that I wore outside my dress, which was what made it so funny. And, you know, so we're performing this show. And then when the audience came and they laughed all through the first part, and then we crucified the Jesus clown, and everybody started crying, especially me. And then I realized, this is it. If you can get them to laugh, and then you can get your point across with humor. And it somehow reflected my life. That it could be so sad and so tragic, but it doesn't stand alone. It has to have humor as well. Somehow it reflected my life to me, these two opposing ideas, tragedy and humor. And then I fell in love with Charlie Chaplin at Carnegie Mellon University because he does that so fabulously. You know, when you're watching the little Jew in the great dictator, and it's scary because you know something terrible is going to happen, but you're laughing at Chaplin's antics because he's not aware of what's going to happen.
Right. You write a lot about that freedom you felt in Godspell.
Oh my goodness. The theater could have been on fire. And I would have prevailed in my part.
How long were you with that production?
About a year, over a year. I had to stay in New York because I got Sesame Street right away after, you know, sort of. So the whole company went to the West Coast and then they toured and I missed that part. And I wasn't in the movie because Sesame Street said, look, I was just there. So they weren't going to like bend over backwards for me. So they said, like, either take the movie.
Or take Sesame Street. Was that a hard choice for you?
I had no idea what to do. I just...
How did you end up deciding?
I let the agent decide. I didn't know what to do. And then, years later, my friends from Godspell said, boy, you know, you made the right decision sticking with Sesame Street. I said, yeah, thanks. And then they also said, but at that time, we thought you were making the biggest mistake of your life. And I said, and not one of you told me?
The audition for Sesame Street, the audition for Sesame kind of ends, or doesn't kind of, it does end your memoir. It's so unlike any audition that I've ever experienced. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it was. This was in 1970. There was a time, listeners, when one person could make a decision on a creative project. And it was John Stone, and John Stone was one of the great creative forces of Sesame Street. It was really Joan Cooney gave him the task to come up with a show that talked to the inner city child. And it was he who said, then it has to be set in Harlem. Then it has to have people of color on it. And it was he auditioned me because first the show was geared toward African-American children with Susan and Gordon. That was the audience. And then in the 60s, everybody had a platform. All of these Mexican-American activists on the West Coast said, well, we demand equal representation. And then Sesame Street said, okay, cool. So then they, you know, they opened it up for to get some Latino actors. And there weren't a lot of us. I think there were three.
Are you being literal?
I am being literal. There weren't a lot of us that I could recall.
So you would all go in for the same stuff.
We'd all go in for the same stuff, and so Raul Julia got cast.
Yeah.
Emilio Delgado got cast, and I got cast as Maria. And then the audition, it was simple. I went into his office. We did a sorting song. I didn't have to sing, just I had to figure out why one thing was not like another. Mm-hmm. He said, explain this to me as if I was a four-year-old child. Then he said, tell me a scary story as if I was a four-year-old child. I had a million of those.
I bet.
And then he said, well, you don't have to sing because you're in a musical. Ha ha. Little did he know that, you know, the only thing I could sing was Godspell because it was written for me. So,
as you said, that the original intention was to offer programming to undeserved African-American kids. And then you said it was born from activism and that it set out to eradicate racism through equal opportunity and representation. Now we're 45, 46, 47 years on. Has Sesame Street failed in its mission?
Well, I think failed is too strong a word. I really thought in that my idealistic, it was very, America was idealistic at that time. And we were going to change the world. And young people, I thought, oh, well, now all of these races are going to die. And because now it's, we've uncovered this concept that it does exist. And we will, you know, we'll all be the country that we aspire to be. The education gap is still wide open. There's obvious the most horrible racism in America that shocked me. Mm-hmm. I can't believe the things that people say, that public leaders say.
Without naming any names.
Without naming any. I mean, I would have been sent to the principal's office to say stuff like, it would have been on my personal record. No, what are they called?
Permanent record.
Permanent record, on my permanent record. But we've done quite a bit. Sesame Street did quite a bit. And I know that because people have told me. A writer named Kate Messner came up to me, writes a lot of young adult novels, and she said, I would never have thought of getting a job and working if I hadn't seen Maria asks for a raise on Sesame Street. It was a little moment that she saw when she was a kid, and that made me feel wonderful. A woman with dark hair, who's the pianist at one of the hotels in the city, said to me, I was raised in Utah. And if you were the one that I related to as being like me, because I said, you're kidding. She said, no, I was absolutely ostracized because I was dark. And she was white, but she had dark hair, dark curly hair. And countless Latin people who have said, you were the first Latin that I saw that was on television that was like me, that made me seem visible. Because if I see myself reflected in you, therefore I am also a person.
Did it ever feel like a burden being the Latina on Sesame Street?
Only in the beginning, there was a group from San Francisco. It was a women's group. This is like feminism was like just in the early stages of it. And this group from San Francisco latched on me as being like a great role model for little girls. And I just didn't know what to do with it. I was terrified. I just... wait a minute, when did I become a spokesperson?
Right, and you're in your early
20s. Yeah.
You're 22, 23,
right,
whatever it is.
Right. Or, and when did I become a spokesperson for Puerto Ricans? I'm not a political, you know, I mean, it was like so. It was scary in the beginning, but I was doing we were doing the first Sesame Street movie, and there was some dialogue that was being said while the camera was panning puppets, and the dialogue said, Sesame Street is full of men and women while we're seeing these furry creatures. And I said to the director, wait, I don't think you should say that because they're not men and women. I mean, we think of something else. And they said, okay, what do you think we should do? And I think I suggested something. And they said, good idea. So then I felt powerful. I mean, I solved the problem.
Mm-hmm. And you eventually became a writer on Sesame Street.
Yeah, in exactly the same way. The writers, we'd have meetings, and the writers would say, what do you want to do? And I'd say, I like this, I like this, I want to do this. And then they would write my suggestions, which validated them for me. And then there was an exquisite executive producer, Dulcie Singer, who finally said, why don't you try writing some of these and stop complaining about
it. Right. Hey, lady, if you think it's so easy.
Oh, that's right. She did. She came to me and she gave me this huge book. It was as big as an old-fashioned New York telephone book. Uh-huh. Probably nobody knows what that is, but she said, these are the goals that we try to address.
Right.
Take it home. Take a look.
No pressure.
No pressure. And she actually said to me, now you'll see, you know, what, you know, I was in the control room and I saw that sometimes there was a puppet gave a great performance, but we saw his head. Mm-hmm. So you had to choose between the great performance that's, you know, technically not great, or the not as great performance that's technically perfect. I mean, there were a lot of decisions that had to be made on the spot. So I learned a lot.
I remember, even as a kid, watching Sesame Street and having some awareness that it was a television show being made in some television world. But I couldn't grasp, and still can't quite grasp, how you were making, I feel like, I read it was like upwards of 100 episodes
yes,
a year.
160
episodes of Sesame Street per year. Can you just technically explain to me how that was possible? What was a day like on Sesame Street?
We had very long production seasons. It was like school. You'd start September and go to November, then take a long Christmas break, and then hit it in January again. And every Friday was Muppet Day for those Muppet inserts, and they were hilarious. Every Thursday was cast inserts, which means I could get dressed up like Charlie Chaplin, or we would do sketch comedy, like variety show sketch comedy.
So you would just shoot a bunch of these, and then they could go anywhere in any episode.
And then they would go anywhere. And then Monday through Wednesday were the storylines of the street. And it was, I don't want to say casual, but you know, kids were picking their noses. Well, we just went on, you know.
Right.
It had that live television quality to it. If there was a boom in the shot, we'd do it again. But John Stone would always tell celebrities when they came on, we'd run through it once, and he'd say, "Okay, that was the dress rehearsal in the tape."
Right, come prepared.
We would do it all, you know, all at once.
Did it ever?
And we could use our own words, so we didn't have to memorize exactly what was written, which helped, obviously.
Right.
Oh, Oscar. A beautiful, perfect yellow rose.
Yeah, I knew you liked them. Yuck. Well, let's start her up here. Okay, here I go. Now, don't move. Just stand there, okay? I want to remember you, just like that. Geronimo!
Why do I do anything for him? Why?
Did you ever feel like you were trapped in Sesame Street?
No, in the beginning I was unsure because the tendency was to try to compete with a Muppet for attention, for the laugh, for, you know, what, and that's, you cannot compete with Muppet, pets, dogs, or kids. As an actor, you know that. And so when I understood that I was a straight man, that I had to set up the joke so I could say to Big Bird, "I don't know, Big Bird, how many feathers do you think you have?" And then he delivers the punchline. Once I understood that was our relationship, I said, "I got this. I understand this."
As an actress, did you ever want to like take a break and try to do something else, or was it just were you content to have a job?
I was. There was a lot of auditions because this was the years of Norman Lear when mm-hmm. there were a lot of more people of color on television, and but still I would go up for the wisecracking black girl. Well, there was a real black girl that was better at it than me right away. There were still weren't any Latinos except for Chico and the Man, and you still had to either have an accent. I mean, the fact that you were Puerto Rican had something to do with the character.
Right.
Whereas on Sesame Street, it was just me. Being Puerto Rican wasn't, I mean, it was, but it wasn't. I just could exist. On a sitcom in those days, if you saw a Latin person, you waited for the taco joke.
Right.
I mean, that was the reason they were there. You know, they weren't there to, like, help.
Right. And in a sense, it was more political for you to just be Maria than to be the Latina Maria.
Right, right. Though everything that I do is Latin.
Right.
By virtue of, you know, who I am. In my books, my picture books, they're all going to be little Latin stories because that's my window.
You were talking about earlier the revolutionary time that Sesame Street emerged, that you emerged. This is the late 60s, early 70s, when all things felt possible. Do you look around today and recognize some of that same social upheaval at work? How is it similar or dissimilar from your formative years?
I think that the fact that we can communicate on Facebook and Twitter has made communication less possible.
Can you explain that?
I think because, you know, I go on Facebook and I tweet, but I'm tweeting to like minds.
Right.
I think Amy Walters said it on PBS NewsHour.
I'll give you credit for it.
And she said that people just, you know, you talk to the people who agree with you. And I think in the late 60s, in that era of idealism, we listened to other people. At Sesame Street especially, we would have, like, you know, people from the community would come and say, you people are wrong. What are you, you know, Navajos would come and say, what the heck is it? You know, and, you know, we would listen to them and try to incorporate in the show. But now it's like we take a stand and, you know, dig in. So there's no discourse.
Do you feel like Sesame Street could launch today in the same way that it did?
Never. You couldn't do a show like that today.
Why?
Because, first of all, shows now often, children's shows, I suspect, start out with marketing charts.
Right.
First of all, they say, like, oh, you can't have Big Bird. How are you going to make a stuffed animal like Big Bird? We can't sell that. Forget it. You know, or they're going to say, how is this going to fly in Taiwan in 30 years? I mean, how should we know? Let's do something. So I think that we're so careful now about the children's programming, which is appropriate. But I think there's a little magic that's left out of it now. And I think that it has to do with our obsession with data and computers, where you want a kid to learn something from what he's watching. So you'll say, well, did you learn it? You got to test them. If it doesn't test, then it's no good.
Right.
So let me remind you of a wonderful Sesame Street bit. I walk in the studio and there's Lena Horne singing It's Not Easy Being Green with Kermit the Frog.
It's not easy being green. Having to live each day the color of the leaves. When I think it would be so much nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. No, it's not so easy being green. Seems you blend in with so many ordinary things. And people, they tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like splashy sparkles in the water. Or like stars in the sky.
Okay, and I'm thinking, are they singing about what I think they're singing about? I mean, there's Lena Horne with all of her gravitas in her life, and, you know. So how do you test that to a kid? Do you say, like...
Do you get it,
do
kid?
Do you get it? I mean, so people say, like,
hey,
well,
kid.
Hey, yeah, did you get it? I mean, whereas this, you can get it on 1,000 levels.
Right.
And so we're limited now.
Was there a point in your career, because clearly you're passionate about this stuff, was there a point when the label of actress was no longer big enough to encompass how you felt about your career? And do you know when that happened?
Well, I'm never going to say it. I mean, I... Yeah, I'd be a fool to say, oh, I'm not just an actress.
But clearly, I hear the passion in your voice about the educational component of Sesame Street. And at some point, you, Sonia, had to buy into that. And even here, sitting here, you're proselytizing about it.
Yeah,
and it's clearly
I am.
A mission you believe
Sorry.
In. No. I'm reluctant often to speak with actors or actresses for precisely this reason, because the box that they're in is pretty narrow. Your box is much wider, and I'm wondering, was that a gradual process for you? Was there a moment where you felt like, you know what, I'm invested in this as a whole person as opposed to just my role as Maria?
I don't think there is a moment. I think it happens over time. When I found myself reading the whole script for the show,
instead of just Maria.
Baloney, my line, baloney, my line. And baloney's not usually the word that's used, but
right. Because I... Elmo says some bullshit,
Oscar says some bullshit. And then I speak. And I'll be the first actor to admit to doing a little of that in my time. But still, I was always interested in seeing the whole show. I was just... And I was... fascinated by the show when I first saw Susan and Gordon on it, and I wasn't on it. I said, oh my goodness, black people on television from an inner city street, and that looks like Hooper Stewart is like the guy on the corner, just like me. It was really an amazing, because I had spent all my time watching Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and Romper Room and Sandy Becker and those weird children's programming of the 50s. I became what I needed to see myself when I was a kid.
Well, that's interesting.
So I always think that there's another kid out there watching me the way I watched in a chaotic environment with parents like my parents.
Was it hard to walk away from that?
From Sesame Street?
Yeah.
Well, I think that after so many years, of course, everybody thinks their time on the show was the golden era of the show. It's been 40 years, but I think that the golden era was Mr. Hooper.
Your
my
golden
era,
44 years.
My
yeah.
golden. It was Hooper's death. It was the, you know, the adoption of Miles. There were human stories. There were Maria's wedding. Maria has a baby, and all of this kind of reality show stuff. And so I think that leaving the show, I mean, I think that my purpose kind of, the show changed direction. I didn't know where I was going to fit in with the new direction. And of course, it was tough to leave because it changed my whole life being on that show. I wasn't contributing as much as I had hoped. Hmm. They would always ask my opinion about things and then do something else.
And then you moved into writing.
Yes.
And how has that transition been for you?
Oh, it's great. I started writing. They're all little, as I said, Frank McCourt kind of inspired me. But I first started writing picture books, little memoirettes, I thought. And they were challenging moments that I had as a kid that I've put in picture books and made them, given them happy endings or, you know, rearranged. You can sort of control your life. You know, you put this stuff down that happens to you and make it turn out the way you want it to. And I think that I'm, you know, I hope that kids are are intrigued and see a different, think of something else. That's like what inspiring is. To inspire someone is not so they could, you don't inspire someone to do what you did.
Right.
You inspire them to do something.
Anything. Yeah.
You know, so.
But a lot of,
my books do that.
A lot of writers, performers, whomever, when they talk about their audience, they speak in terms of other adults, but it seems like you still think of your audience as children.
I do. I'm interested in them. I think that they have I think each generation is another shot at getting it right.
And one time they will.
Someday they will. You know, because, you know, I love the kids are pragmatic. You know, I think it's when I watch the news and there is all these Syrian kids in these horrible situations, one of them will look at the camera and sort of wink and smile because the camera's looking at them. I think that that's something that impresses me somehow. And that they think of their own solutions. You know, you'll think like, oh my gosh, there's not enough space in the world for all the people. And some kid says, so what? We're going to be living in the stars by then. You know, it's that kind of thinking that I.
It sounds like you have always been and remain an optimist.
Probably.
I mean, you seem so joyful and so optimistic. Is it just a front? Are you... Is that really?
No, I find a beauty in things.
Great.
I mean, I find, you know, like I'll go see a, you know, I'll think about the, you know, whatever movie I saw yesterday or whatever music I'm hearing. And that's where, go for the art. When in trouble, go for the art.
All right. As we wrap up, what is the best advice you ever received?
I don't know.
That's a totally fair answer.
I don't know.
What's the best advice you would give to somebody who maybe doesn't look like everybody else and wants to make their mark on the world?
I think in whatever forum someone decides to go into is to actually see what it is. Make no assumptions until you see what it is. I think we sabotage ourselves a lot.
We close each episode of How to Be Amazing with the Amazing Five, in which I will give you five categories of things, and I'm just looking for a recommendation in each of these categories. So because I have not eaten today, I will start with food.
Oh, gosh.
Knishes?
I love knishes, and I also love, there's a woman outside, that there are some people that walk around in carts that have like breakfast tamales.
Not in my neighborhood in Connecticut.
Not in your
they
neighborhood
don't.
In Connecticut. Oh, darn. I like the breakfast tamales and the oatmeal that they serve.
What's a breakfast tamale? It's just eggs or something in a corn?
No, it's just corn. It's just the cornmeal, but it's fresh. It's fresh. And she's always selling them like it's 7 o'clock in the morning. So that's why it's breakfast.
Okay, breakfast tamales. What about books?
Oh gosh, that's tough.
They're all tough.
I just reread my beloved world, Sonia Sotomayor's book, Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Is that her memoir?
It's her memoir. It's really great. And I'll quote something she says in it that stayed with me. I had read it before, but I just reread it. She said, "If you call me a spick, it tells me a lot about you and nothing about me." Mm-hmm. So that's a chock full of quotable sentences. You could...
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Music.
I was just... You talk about the joyous. Maybe I'm feeling so good today because on the way over here, I was listening to an old 1970s recording, Pacheco y su Charanga. And I am just really, immersed in Cuban music.
Why specifically Cuban, do you know?
Because I'm writing my next book takes place in Cuba. It starts out in Cuba in 1958. So I'm like immersed in that music that I was raised with, but I'm getting more specific about it. So, downloading music from the 70s, Latin music from the 70s.
Movies.
I just saw something and it went in one eye and out the other.
I hope it's not coming out of your eyes.
No. What was it? Oh, dear. I love Woody Allen. I like Cafe Society. It was wonderful. The best line in that was, live every day like it's your last and someday you'll be right.
It sounds like you just love comedy.
Yes.
Did you ever think to pursue any kind of comedy beyond just Sesame Street stuff?
No, no. And it's funny, because of Sesame Street, I assumed that everybody had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, you know, and I've been on sets, I'm not going to tell you what show, where I cracked a joke when I was up there, and it, you know, it was like I had a terrible bodily function, because people just don't take to it all the time. Right. And I assumed that everybody had a sense of humor, and it's just not true.
Was it a fun set in that way?
Oh, gosh. It was like, you know, the puppets would try to crack you up so that right. you wouldn't get your lines right. It was, you know, you'd kick them under the table and try to keep a straight face. I mean, it was real. It was very fun. You know, it was funny. It was funny all the time.
The final category is a miscellaneous. Anything from your life that you would recommend to somebody else?
I thought the first thing that popped into my head was Orchard Beach.
Perfect. That's a perfect
go to Orchard Beach and then City Island for some shrimp.
Well, Sonia Manzano, I want to thank you so much for coming in and being a part of How to Be Amazing. Thank you so much for 44 years of Maria and continued success with your books.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you for being amazing. This is Michael Egan Black saying farewell.
Adios.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. Say how handsome I sound. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio, New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Jason Saldanha with music composed by Chad Crouch. I am, as always, Michael Ian Black.